A lot of digital forensics is looking at a puzzle and trying to understand what pieces are missing. We deal with facts and we deal with evidence and we leave it to the proverbial, you know, jury, if you will, but really to the law firm to interpret those forensic facts. And so ultimately, we actually found some interesting pieces of the puzzle. We got lucky.
When one B2B design company noticed that they were losing business every single month after an IT employee quit, Devin Ackerman and his team at Kroll Cyber stepped in to help. This is the Cyber Crime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see. Today, Andy has invited Devin Ackerman to the Cyber Crime Lab. Devin is a former FBI agent and currently the regional managing director at Kroll Cyber. He'll be sharing two very different cyber attacks. One involved the B2B design company mentioned at the top of the episode. The other was a hospital. Devin fills us in about the specifics of each and how his team handled a life and death situation in the most literal sense of the word.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Cybercrime Lab podcast. For those who don't know your background, I'd love if you just took 30 seconds and told some folks about how you got into this in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Andy. So my name is Devin Ackerman. I am currently a regional managing director with Kroll Cyber. I lead our incident response and digital forensics-based investigations for North America. And so ultimately, I have a large amount of teams, very experienced practitioners. And that's actually where I came from as well. Before Kroll, been with Kroll about 6 years. Before Kroll, I was a supervisory special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I led investigations and partook in those on the, both the national security side, but also the criminal side, both here within the U.S. and beyond. So that's my background in a nutshell. The only other thing that people find a little interesting is I have four kids, two boys, two girls, and that keeps me very busy. But otherwise, I have an awesome job and love what I do.
So fun. Four kids. You're well into zone defense there. I was so looking forward to this conversation because you just have a wealth of experiences and have seen what it's like to live through one of these cyber attacks day in, day out. Normally, we only hear one story, but with you, we might actually hear a few of kind of specific stories. You know, I'd love to maybe just start with the story that you were telling me about a designer and some of the issues that they had with an attack.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a fun story. So let's dive in. So Kroll was approached several years ago by a law firm representing a client of theirs, and they were like, I've got an odd one for you. And it's always fun to us when clients or law firms or insurance carriers come to us, we're like, we've got a different one for you, because we get to put on our thinking hat. It's business email compromises and nation state threat groups and malware. A lot of it is rinse and repeat. The intrusions stay very similar, right? Ransomware, we absolutely can do, but it usually follows a methodology. We like it when they're abnormal. We like it when they're different. So law firm approached us, said, hey, I've got a new one for you. And this is really all I know. My client is losing business every single month. Like their clients, their suppliers are just cutting their contracts and they're leaving them. They're going to, we think, a competitor. And we suspect it's about the same time and this all started was when one of their main IT employees left them. We suspect he took stuff. We can't prove it. It's just suspicion. We want to sue him in court. We want to reclaim some of this business. We don't want our customer to fail and go bankrupt, but we got to have some actual evidence to our theories here.
If you're familiar with the tales of cyber attacks, you know that a disgruntled former employee is a common culprit. The former IT employee in this story ultimately decided to share important company information with the competition. Though they may not have been disgruntled, they did, however, fall victim to petty greed, leading to damage in terms of lost accounts and the sharing of sensitive customer information.
And so we were engaged. So Kroll Cyber ultimately was engaged. And now this is all played out years later, and I'll keep the details high level. But ultimately, this was not your standard investigation. A lot of digital forensics investigations or incident response investigations, a lot of your audience will probably know, typically you're looking at logs, you're looking at a computer, a server, maybe something from a firewall, and you're telling a story of something that happened on a date and a time and what may have been viewed or accessed or exfiltrated. That's what we do. We're storytellers. Well, right off the bat, we asked for the normal things. Okay, so tell us about this prior employee. When they told us about the employee, he's the one IT guy. They only had one for this business. And he left, and they think he went to a competitor, but they didn't know for sure. They actually didn't know what he was doing. He didn't have an online presence, but they suspected he had gone to this competitor. How about we start with his computer? Sure, but we think he wiped it. Okay, well, that's suspicious, and that's also going to really stink for us because that's where we probably have a lot of evidence. All right, so let's get the computer. How about his phone? We think he factory reset that too. Okay. Did he have anything else? Well, he had two iPads, but he factory reset those too. All right, we're 4 for 4 and a strikeout. And based on the model and the devices, there was no recovery options that would have netted us any good data from the cell phone or the iPads. And so we looked at the computer. Is there any way that we can restore data from the hard drives, recover things, maybe from drive free space or make any useful data? And the answer is no. The employee had done a full secure overwrite of all the data with a single pass and it was all gone. All right. So we've now lost 4 major pieces of evidence. When did the employee leave was part of our next kind of line of questioning. We left almost 6 months ago. All right, do you have any networking logs? Do you have anything else? Tell us about your technology, your network. Look, we're real basic here. We design a particular type of item, and that item gets sold business to business and they resell it in stores. And ultimately, technology and security was never really the front of what we did. We hire people to make things and we sell those things. Okay, so we don't have any logs. We don't think we even have any technology from when this employee was here. What are we going to do? And that's where the attorney was like, this is why I need someone to think outside the box.
As it turns out, heading to the proverbial scene of the crime is what would go on to save this design firm. Devin appropriately calls this out-of-the-box thinking, and a great piece of advice for any fellow threat attack fighters who may be listening.
So we ultimately ended up sending someone on site to the single location in a very large U.S. city. And we basically said, show us where the employee sat. And by the way, is anyone in there? No. We closed the door. We haven't hired anyone to replace them. And we've been using a contractor who remote works for us. Okay. So we went into the office. It was basically just like the person had left 6 months prior. And we sat down. And the employee we sent was a former law enforcement officer. He had done a lot. He had spent 20 years doing investigations. And he basically came up with the idea himself. He's like, I just want to think for a while. And he basically did exactly that. He sat in the office and he tried to think, how would I work day to day here? What's missing? And he started realizing, look, the computer here, it's the hard drives. Yeah, like this is the one where the hard drives wiped. Okay, now I understand that. He started looking at the monitors. Are there extra cables sitting around? Are there hard drives? He started realizing there were things that just seemed a little amiss to him. There should be something here. It's no longer here. We ended up finding out later it was what we call a drive array or a RAID device. It had a lot of storage in it. We actually found the plugs for it, but there was no device anymore. That'll come to interesting a little bit later in the story.
So what is a RAID device, or RAID? As Devin briefly mentions, RAID stands for Redundant Array of Independent Disks. Simply put, it's a technique for storing the same data on multiple hard disks. It can increase read performance and help keep your data safe. However, in the world of cybercrime, safety is never guaranteed. And in the case of this company, the RAID device was the source of their data leak.
And so he started realizing other things. Like there's a server over in the side of the room. And so that server's running and he asked him, what's on this server? Oh, it has our email softwares on there. It has our customer database on there. It has all of our order information. Like that is the one server that everything in our business runs off of. Okay, it's in his office. That makes sense. He's the IT administrator. But just to be clear, that's where all of the keys to the kingdom live. And by the way, we think this employee took everything that matches what would be on that server, right? Yes. Okay, let's start looking at the server. Took us about a week or two to do the investigation. And when we started looking into it, it was for your audience. It wasn't a typical Windows server. It was actually a Linux box. And so a lot of the logging you traditionally find on more Windows-based servers, we have very different types of logging we look for, or more different artifacts we look for in a Linux environment. And ultimately, we started finding some pieces of a puzzle. A lot of digital forensics is looking at a puzzle and trying to understand what pieces are missing. You don't always have all the answers, but from experience and from training, you look at a puzzle and you realize what should be here is this piece. Now, how do I go find that piece? Or what should be here in this part of the story, it actually makes, I can make a logical assumption or assessment of what should be here. And so we ended up finding that a lot of the logs from that employee's time frame were well, they had rolled over. They were no longer there. So what else do we have to work off of? If we're going to take data, we're either going to copy it to a device or we're going to stage it. We're going to copy the data. We're going to move it to another part of the server and we're going to start to save it in a folder. If you've got a folder on your desktop, you drag a whole bunch of files there and you drag the folder to a thumb drive and you unplug the thumb drive and you walk out of your office. A lot of us do this with our taxes. Maybe we'll move the files to a thumb drive and we take the thumb drive to the accountant. We started looking for things like that. And so ultimately, we actually found some interesting pieces of the puzzle. We realized there was an entire folder structure that had been created about 7 months prior, so about a month before the employee left. And it had, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff we were hoping we wouldn't find. It had an entire backup of the entire customer database saved as a single file.
And so the culprit was found out. Through the use of the RAID device that they had stolen, they were able to import an entire customer database, which would include important emails from the design company.
We found a what we would call a database dump of their email software going back 8 years. As you can imagine, all the client contacts, all the business-to-business relationships, the client had told us and had painted a story for us, look, we're losing all our business. Our suppliers are stopping their contracts. They're not servicing anymore. We think they've gone to a competitor. You and I both know, Andy, everything we do basically is email nowadays, right? So if you want to really punch in the gut of a business, you take their email, you take their client lists, and then what else is interesting? We started thinking about what else is intellectual property for them. What is unique that if you want to steal their business, you'd want to impersonate or steal? How about their designs, their product designs? That's unique to them. Maybe the manufacturing process. We had to figure out where that was. And we found a particular text file, which was very interesting for us. So think of it like this. Think if you have a filing cabinet in the corner of your office. And in the bottom drawer of the filing cabinet, someone had left a note and it said, I copied files on this date. And that was all that the file said in the filing cabinet, right? Maybe a secretary leaves that in there and says, I copied these files on this date for this person. We found a text file like that, but more technical. A piece of software had run on the server and it had written out a log file. And it basically was a copy job being completed around the same time frame as all those other files were being found in that other part of the server. And so this is where we start building this timeline. We start building this puzzle board, right? All right, now we've got this large amount of data being copied. That seems suspicious, but it fits our timeline. We know we have a backup of the email software. That seems suspicious timing-wise. And we have this large customer database output file, this backup file. That is basically everything you need in our perspective, in our assessment, to deal from this company and go to a competitor. But again, they're just pieces of the puzzle, right? I can't necessarily link this to this person having stolen this stuff yet. It's just a lot of suspiciousness on a server timing-wise. So what are we missing? How did the person walk out of the office with this?
It was time for Devin and his team to dig deeper. Where could they find proof that the former IT employee had actually stolen something?
So we started asking questions. Do you have any surveillance cameras? Well, we do actually, but it's only on the back loading dock door. Okay, where is that footage? Well, that footage is offloaded to a security provider. You know, actually we use it so we remote unlock the door so that when the trucks pull up, we can raise the truck doors and they go in. Okay, but if someone leaves the door, would we potentially capture the foot traffic? Yeah, maybe. How long do you have that video for? About a year. Let's start pulling video footage from about 6 to 7 months ago and let's see if we can capture this employee coming and going through the back door. We ended up reviewing almost 60 days worth of video footage. And interestingly enough, we had one day in time, about 2 weeks before the employee left, and about 4 to 5 days after we started seeing all these files being stored on the server, where the individual walks out with a backpack. The backpack was something that was very abnormal to us because this employee never walks in or out with a backpack. Never. We looked at 60 days worth of footage. They come in by themselves, nothing in their hands, maybe a coffee now and then, maybe a soda now and then. That day in particular, they walked to work with what appeared to us to be a very lightweight backpack with nothing in it. And they seemed to walk out with a different position on their back. And so this is where the more traditional investigative lens that we bring to the table with our clients mixes with the cyber aspect of what we do, remember? So this employee, this former law enforcement officer we sent on site, starts putting all these pieces together. He's like, look, I've got timing. I have suspicions. I have data on a server indicative of things being staged like you would do if you're going to steal. I've got them coming and going from work with something that could conceal hard drives. And ultimately, I have this spot on the desk where I think there probably would have been a large hard drive, and it's not here anymore.
This story stands as a good example of how sometimes an investigation calls for you to take some old school tactics. In fact, Kroll Cyber has a special private investigative section of their business for situations exactly like this one.
Well, how about we look to see if there's purchases, maybe historical purchases on credit cards, maybe corporate credit cards. Maybe this employee made a mistake. Maybe they were a little foolish. Maybe they bought some hard drives on a corporate card and we have evidence of them buying. We got lucky. We ended up viewing about 12 months worth of receipts and invoices, and specifically for this employee on what they've been purchasing off Amazon and Best Buy and other stores, ended up finding a large RAID array, held 12 hard drives, large box-like device that they had bought online from a particular provider, and we found the receipt for it. It was actually 2 months before they had left the company, so about a month before they started staging stuff on the server. So now we start putting all this together. Now look, has there been a legitimate reason for that? Absolutely. Maybe they were running backup routines. So now you've got one more piece of the puzzle. And to us, we're looking at this from a standpoint of they probably took it, but we deal with facts and we deal with evidence and we leave it to the proverbial jury, if you will, but really to the law firm to interpret those forensic facts. There was one last piece of evidence that makes this case very interesting. We actually found evidence of a, we call a mail rule. So in, remember that server I talked about kind of did everything for this business. There was one particular mailbox on that server that had a mail rule that had been disabled but not deleted. The mail rule specifically captured a copy of every message incoming to the president and the CFO of the company and routed it, a copy of it, to an external email address that was not a business domain. So every email coming to the president, every email coming to the CFO, all the business transactions, all the invoices and accounts payable, all copies of all those emails. And again, this is just a rule in and of itself, but the creation date on it, almost a year prior. So for 6+ months, in our opinion, this rule could have been copying messages and sending. So now we have a year's worth of data. We have a year's worth of puzzle pieces, and we ultimately have a presentation to our client. So we present all of our findings to our client. And one of the last things they say to us, these are really great findings. We understand it's not necessarily a smoking gun. We think there's plenty here for us to do a lawsuit. We still don't know if this employee actually went to the competitor. Can you help us find that out? So a more traditional way of looking at this, part of Kroll is we have a particular part of our business that does PI, private investigator type investigations. And so they retained us to ultimately do surveillance. And it was all in public spaces. It was all within the legal guidelines of the states we operated in. But we ultimately were hired by the company to watch this employee and understand where they went to work. And we realized that they ultimately were driving to a particular office building where our competitor, our client's competitor, was on one of the floors. And what was very interesting about that is one day they came out with a swag bag with the competitor's logo on it, confirming that they had been to that office. And so it was a great case. It's a great story where it merged all of the traditional aspects of an investigation with the cyber aspects. And all I'll say is that our client ultimately won their lawsuit. So how about that?
And again, like a normal crime story just played out in cyberspace and all this sort of circumstantial evidence can build a case. For someone who doesn't think about this, right? Technically, this would be criminal because they stole data and whatnot. If you didn't live through these types of cases the way that you do, for the most part, law enforcement probably wouldn't be interested in this case. Maybe not. I wonder, why are they pursuing sort of civil means versus criminal means in this case?
in our consulting space and in really the history of our company, we were actually formed originally to help with that civil space, to be investigators for companies where it may not have enough evidence to go criminal. Or to your point, law enforcement's like, look, we're dealing with murderers, we're dealing with bomb threats, we're dealing with nation state threat groups, hacking companies, like someone who may have stolen the way you make a particular thing that you sell in a big brand store, a big box store, is not necessarily criminal unless you bring us more evidence. And that's where a company like Kroll comes in. That's what somewhere like what we do comes in, where we ultimately are hired to look at investigations and build a story, collect the evidence that they ultimately can then take back to law enforcement. And we've done that many times. We've been hired or retained to ultimately do the investigation. And then we turn it over to the client, the law firm, and they take it to law enforcement. We're like, okay, now this is a much better story. Now we can involve, you've got something here. And we've got enough to open it with the AUSA for federal. We've got enough to open it with the district attorney or ADA on the state level. So yes.
Two things that I had not realized before I was working in the space was one, the difference in terms of criminal versus civil, in terms of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt versus preponderance of evidence. The standard to prove is much lower in a civil case. And then the other thing is you appreciate how many cases law enforcement is dealing with, right? Internet crime report from the FBI included, I think, close to 700,000 cases that were reported to them last year. Just a massive amount. And they only have so many resources. And when you're dealing with ones which are life or death or more, they necessarily need to focus on those.
In the first story shared with us, Devin used traditional investigative measures that made all the difference. However, when called into a hospital to address a ransomware attack, new tactics were needed, and the pressure was on. Lives were at stake, and the situation quickly escalated to one of deadly proportions.
Devin, I think that's actually a really nice way to transition to maybe the other story that you were going to tell us about. You know, a case where, again, things begin to reach potentially life or death type level. You were telling us about this case in the medical space. You mind kind of sharing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I have a feeling ransomware is not only a well-known word, it's a well-recognized word. And I think 10 years ago, people have been like, ransom what? 5 to 10 years ago, we used to do traditional ransom investigations. Someone would get kidnapped and ultimately you have a ransom, right? They're holding that person for ransom. And that's the things of Hollywood. But in law enforcement world, we work that. We work those cases. I worked a lot of them in my FBI career. Not so much on the civil side, right? Typically, we've kidnapped someone that is absolutely within the territory and domain of law enforcement. You should let the professionals handle it. But organized crime groups and really criminal groups, we'll call it what it is. Criminals that ultimately say, hey, maybe I can make money off of hacking into a network and encrypting their data. Well, that we all know that's ransomware. There's an article that I'm actually working on writing right now, and it talks about really the psychological after effects of ransomware beyond the technical. I think everyone, I think, largely understands the technical. Bad guy hacks in, bad guy drops ransomware, holds it hostage, you either pay him or you restore from backups. Story's been told 1,000 times. But there's a psychological aspect to it. There's the stressor point.
Often when discussing a cyber attack, we can leave out a big piece of the story, the emotional and psychological toll. When a ransomware attack threatened to take down a hospital, as you can imagine, emotions were running extremely high.
The story that you and I were talking about prior, client approached Kroll and said, look, we've been hit with ransomware. It was late on a holiday weekend leading into a Friday, Saturday morning, about midnight, actually, we got the call. And we ended up pulling a team together to help scope a matter with our clients so we can get them contracts and paperwork. And really, the scoping call is meant to be very high level and straightforward. What's happened? How big is your network? Give us some technical details. What kind of logs you have? Who are going to be our points of contact? Great. We got enough now for a statement or scope of work and a set of contracts. They sign, we sign, we're off and running, we get down to business. There's an aspect to ransomware that I think a lot of your audience should at least hear about once, and it ultimately is that emotional aspect of it. This particular client was in the medical space, it'll be very apparent from the story, and the person on the call, and I was on this call, was ultimately extremely emotionally distraught. And the story they basically explained to us was, look, we are turning away ambulances right now. We are turning away 911 calls. So the ransomware had actually knocked out the servers that not only controlled the OR rooms, the operating rooms, but it also controlled all of the prescription medicine, all of the vaccine information, all of the medical chart systems. Their electronic records were totally offline. Even their intake systems were now offline. So if you walked in, and all of us have been to hospitals, all of us have been to doctor's office, you walk in, they hand you a chart, and they start typing that information to get you in so they can move you to the rooms. It's all offline. And so the individual on the call is explaining to us, high up executive within this particular medical care facility. And they're like, look, I'm turning away ambulances. I'm turning away 911 calls because we're all down right now. And ultimately, lives are hanging in the balance. And the person could tell that they were passionate about what they did, but they were also passionate about the lives they felt directly responsible for. And that's an aspect of what criminals are doing, where they're looking for the financial payout. Right? The average annual income in a lot of third world countries that we believe these organized crime groups operate out of, frankly, is $4,000 to $12,000 US dollars annually as a salary. If they can encrypt one company and ultimately get a $100,000, $500,000, $1 million payout, it's a math problem at that point. Frankly, there's just a clinical disconnect with these criminals when they target hospitals. But there was this emotionally charged call. And frankly, at that point, we're like, we're here to help. What can we do? How quickly can we do it? And what do you need? The ransomware actually have been extremely effective. Another thing, another key point for your audience is that ultimately, you know, ransomware doesn't just happen. It doesn't just get deployed in a network or executed in a network. It doesn't just come to be.
One of the things that I think was really interesting about this case is the stakes are so high. You're ultimately thinking about life or death type stuff. You know, you had to make some of those business decisions that, you know, weighing financial costs versus potentially life and death costs. That's unusual, actually, right? Usually things don't go out of that financial realm. How did you think through, and how did the client think through some of those decisions? What was that like?
So you've got a balance of extreme emotions, right? You've got doctors and medical care providers who are basically saying, you need to do whatever you can to get us up and running now. And you're balancing that with the physical, and your technical audience is going to absolutely understand where I'm coming from. Your mind starts racing with you. How do I get you up and running now? And you're like, there is a path there, but it's not immediate. There are steps every day in place. We're going to do this right. And the other thing we're balancing is we can rush, but how are you sure the bad guy's out of the systems? There's this whole process that typically you have that's built to be strategic. It's built to be defensible. And so sometimes that doesn't happen now. That happens over days and sometimes weeks. There are certain clients that are like, look, we're not a hospital. And if we can get away without paying a bad guy and it takes us down for a couple of weeks, yeah, we're going to figure it out. We're going to do it on paper. You don't have those luxuries, that flexibility, I should say, with healthcare. You have individuals who are dealing with gunshot wounds on the streets, and this is the medical care provider that's at the closest range. You have 911 operators that are trying to route law enforcement officers that are being shot. And so ultimately, you are running a clock. And so you've got a client who's running the please go faster, and you've got the technical hurdles of how do I actually go faster.
The pressure that Devin and his team were under was immense. It's another piece of a cyber attack that often goes unnoticed. There are so many elements that a threat responder needs to keep in mind, between working to contain the attack, figuring out what is setting it off, all while hoping they can catch the actual threat actor.
I think the last thing that I think is interesting with this particular case was ultimately what we found from a malware perspective. There was what we would call triggers that had been left behind. So just the act of regular employees logging into their computers actually did secondary detonations, meaning that when they logged in, it actually kicked off the ransomware on their local system. So servers had been hit first. Every time someone logged into their computer, which a lot of employees started doing, like, is my stuff okay? Or they're showing up for their shift and they're logging their computer. That actually kicked off the ransomware. So it was a whole damage control we were doing and messaging coordination, crisis communication, really, with the client to say, you need to tell your staff of like 1,500 employees across 37 physical locations, do not touch your computers. And we're triaging and really just like an emergency room. You're triaging life and death situations to prioritize.
All of those medical people are saying, no, I need these computers. I'm trying to deal with patients. And literally, it may be life or death with some of those. So like they're used to overriding those types of instructions, right?
Exactly.
And not crazy necessarily to do it.
Yep.
unfortunately, we've got to leave it there just because of time reasons. Devin, this is really fun. I really appreciate the time and all the great stories and the work that you do on a daily basis. I think it's been really great for people to hear what it's like to at least spend some of a day in your world.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe, and more importantly, stay ready.